Healthcare and senior care is fraught with problems and challenges, but we're also seeing some amazing new clinical treatments and resources. This show will help illuminate and uncover the good, bad, and the ugly in order to equip patients, families, and other healthcare providers. Welcome to Senior Care Confidential.
So the hip is one of the hardest working joints in the human body. It's required to take a lot of the load off of our torso and gives us the ability to walk and to move. And when things go wrong, the consequences can be, you know, disastrous in some cases. And sometimes it's just a loss of quality of life. Sometimes it's the loss of mobility and getting around the home. Sometimes it's not being able to enjoy grandkids and those things. And so historically, the only solution for bad hips has been to do a total hip replacement. So today I'm honored to have Dr. Joel Wells with me. He is a fellowship trained comprehensive hip surgeon. He specializes in periacetabular ostomy, or osteotomy, arthroscopic and open hip preservation surgery, hip sport surgery, anterior hip replacements, hip resurfacing, and hip reconstruction. And he is the medical director of the Comprehensive Center Hip Center program at Baylor Scott & White Medical Center, Medical Center in McKinney. So welcome to the show. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Yeah. So give us a little bit of a brief background on you. How did you get into orthopedic surgery? Why hips?
Well, thank you for asking. That's a cool question. And so I grew up in West Texas, in Abilene, Texas, and I grew up wanting to do two things, either play professional baseball or go to medical school. But really not any other medical school. I wanted to go to Tulane, and because my grandparents went there, my great-grandparents went there, and my senior year at Abilene Christian University, I got drafted by the New York Mets and got accepted to Tulane. And it was an awesome opportunity. It just unfortunately happened to be right after Hurricane Katrina. And so I decided to go to medical school to help out New Orleans. And it was a kind of a game time decision. But I was really more excited to go to medical school. And
very cool.
I haven't looked back, and I got the best job in the world.
Yeah. Awesome. Very good. So we were talking about early in the intro, we were talking about hip preservation. So what are some of the considerations that you look at when evaluating a patient, whether it's a preservation type thing or if it's a replacement?
You know, so I think a good way to put it, Brian, is that hip preservation is non-arthroplasty surgery. So non-replacement surgery. And it really stems from the understanding that hips don't just wear out. There's a mechanical reason or anatomic reason. And so if you can correct the anatomy, then you may be able to prevent a hip replacement.
Yeah.
And so usually the most common reasons why I see anatomical deformities are either hip dysplasia or femoroacetabular impingement.
Okay. What are those two? I know what those are. What are those two things for the audience?
Yeah. You kind of think of it as a spectrum. You know, the hip is somewhat like Goldilocks, where it doesn't like too little coverage, but it doesn't like too much coverage and everything in between. Whereas hip dysplasia is more kind of the unstable hip that can create some translational forces to the cartilage that can, increase the wear.
Yep.
Whereas impingement, too little motion. And so it can cause further impingement-related symptoms or counter-coup or kind of secondary instability.
Right.
Both of those—
because the motion has to come from someplace. If I can't get it from primary, then some secondary motion or even like the back is going to have to compensate for it.
Exactly. Yes. Right. And so, you know, what I love is trying to understand, why a hip is hurting and whether it's unstable or impinging or something in between or other reasons. And if you can correct that, hopefully, you can prevent a disease such as hip arthritis.
Okay. What are you finding most often? Is it more hip dysplasia or is it more impingement or to just kind of run the gamut?
You know, if you look at all comers, this is not just my clinic, but I see a lot more hip dysplasia.
Okay.
And the problem is that if hip dysplasia or hip instability is treated as impingement, then you make the instability worse. Whereas impingement, if it's treated as unstable, then you make the impinging worse. And so it's kind of this kind of spectrum where I'm always trying to figure out where the patient is on that spectrum.
Okay. And what kind of diagnostic tests are you using to determine whether it's impingement or or dysplasia? Are there moving type scans that we can do now? Or are they static, or how do you do that?
Yes. And so it is hard, man. Yeah. It really is hard. And so it's from how a patient feels, where their pain is, their genetic makeup, how mobile they are, their range of motion, just something so simple as their hip motion, but then advanced imaging. imaging. And so, yes, we do have a better kind of live time testing with ultrasound, but also CT scans and MRIs that really help guide us.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you just got to sit down and talk with the patient and really understand what they're going through.
Right. More like the clinical presentation versus always relying on the scans or whatever. Yes. Yeah. I remember my son had, my firstborn had hip dysplasia as a young, very young one. And so they did was it Ortolani click test?
Yes. Ortolani Barlow.
So I would imagine that as a 10 pound infant, it's probably easier to do a click test than it is on an 85 year old senior. But do you have some similar testing like that you do manually on them to kind of feel for the dysplasia?
Well, so it's hard to feel for adult dysplasia. Yeah. It's more about understanding their motion and really, identifying their radiographs and their advanced imaging. At the same time, some of these patients that we see even in adulthood or even adolescent may have had issues as a child. Mm-hmm. And so kind of puts your feelers up a little more that, hey, you need to investigate this a little bit more than just a regular x-ray.
If I was someone, so I'm in my 40s, but if I was someone who is concerned about, hey, I'm concerned that I might be having some earlier onset arthritis. Is that when I start contacting someone like you to start? Because I would imagine if I get a hold of this thing earlier, before I've done a lot of wear and tear on the hip, then my outcomes are going to be a little more favorable. My longevity of my original parts might last longer versus having to have an arthroplasty.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes. And so the sooner you can really diagnose it, the better. You know, and the thing is that at the same time, it's really hard to diagnose, you know, like for hip dysplasia on average, and this has been published that patients on average have pain for 5 years and often see 3 healthcare providers, maybe 4, before even coming to a diagnosis. Whereas impingement related symptoms, patients often have pain for 3 to 4 years and see 4 to 5 healthcare providers before even coming to a diagnosis, much less a treatment.
Why is that? Why are they seeing so many? Is it because it's such a complex joint that these 4 or 5 providers that they've seen have not been able to figure out what the true cause of this is, or what am I missing?
If you ain't getting better, you're getting worse, Brian. I'm learning every single day, but all I see for the most part is hips, and I'm continuously learning. And so once you learn so much about one thing, you realize how little you knew about everything else. And so it's hard to just dabble in certain things. And as we're coming more specialized in this arena, you pick up certain things that you may have missed, as a generalist.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's one of the reasons why I like to see specialists myself, because I want the guy who's doing this day in and day out. And that's been your case too. And I know there's a lot of surgeons here who send their patients to you as either a secondary opinion or whatever, because it's something that's maybe a little bit beyond what they're used to seeing, or they know you've got specific expertise in one area. So I know that there are variables that make good candidates for surgery. I think you guys probably call it like, how do we optimize you for surgery, whether it's BMI or it's, nicotine, whatever. What are some of the things that make patients not good candidates for surgeries?
Brian, that's an interesting thing to bring up, is that it's not that any patient's not a great candidate for surgery. Okay. It's more about, for me, understanding that I love every single one of my patients, is that they're more than a hip. And so the thing is, if you get just focused on the hip and, hey, they have hip disease, but they have a lot of other things going on in their life, and they may not be optimal to recover from that surgery. And so it's not that they're not a good surgical candidate, is that there's other aspects within their life, or their nutrition, their emotions, or other things, or their health, that we need to optimize before fixing their hip.
How do you go about finding those things out? Do you guys have your own like intake questionnaire, or you've been doing this for so long, you kind of know like, hey, here's some hot button things we probably need to find out about? Or how do you guys do that? Is it systematized for y'all in your practice?
Yeah. And so, I try to be very standardized, Brian, is that, in order to prevent missing things, you gotta be standardized. And so, yes, there are certain intake forms and of course, patient reported outcome measures, as well as other intake measures that we do. But at the same time, you got to sit down and just chat with the patient and understand where they're coming from. It's not a piece of paper that can diagnose them.
Sure. Okay. And I know you guys do quite a bit of research. Like I've looked at a bunch of yours. And so it sounds like you have, at any one time, there's several research projects going on. What are some of the examples of some of the research you guys have done? What are some interesting findings that you have found doing that?
Yeah, you know, sometimes research gets a bad connotation that patients are being researched. But at the same time, I absolutely love research because my patients guide my research. You know, it's not like, hey, we're just sitting in a lab trying to investigate just one thing. No, it's on the bigger picture of, hey, if patients aren't doing well after certain surgeries or they're doing very well, and why are these patients doing better than others? That's one thing we investigate is patient-reported outcomes, especially in the unique diagnoses that that I may see in the hip. But then also understanding how the spine and pelvis move with the hip. And so that's very important because a lot of research has been done in arthroplasty regarding the hip-spine relationship. But the thing is that patients that before they need a replacement, their spine and pelvis may move aberrantly. And if you can treat that, then, hey, you may be able to improve their hip. And then lastly, you know, understanding their gait pattern and then also their emotional status is so important. And so I like to say that, you know, the research is understanding the patient from the top down, not just one bit of anatomy within the hip.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, because there's so many other aspects. Like we get, I don't know that we do, but there seems to be a, maybe not a mistake, but there might be a trend rather to look at like the human body as like a series of, you know, neurological, biomechanical, you know, biological processes. And you and I both, we've talked about this before. There is like this whole other realm of like the social aspect of things, the emotional aspect of things, that obviously has a great impact on their quality of life and their well-being as well. And a lot of times there's an interplay between what's happening biologically as well as what's going on socially or psychologically. And so, you know, psychologically for folks who have a great deal of pain, so like fibromyalgia, short story real quick. So when I was going through PT school, one of my final internships was at a large outpatient practice in Florida. And this was like early 2000s. And this was back when, I'm a little older than you, this was back when fibromyalgia was like the second most commonly misdiagnosed or diagnosed musculoskeletal problem in the country. And it's like any time we had some sort of a back pain, neck pain issue that we couldn't figure out what was going on, it was like they just slapped the fibromyalgia label on it. And so my clinic had asked me to do a in-service on this for this group of therapists. And it was wild because there's still, even back then, even though it was a little bit misbelieved, like if you got tagged with fibromyalgia back then, there was a stigma attached to that. It's not so much now, but back then it was like, this isn't legit, like it's all in your head, that kind of stuff. And so even after I had presented this in this internship, several therapists came up to me and they're like, you know, this is BS. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not. Like there is this interplay between the psychology part of our body and the biology. And so even back when I was really young, I kind of figured some things out that it was like, there's more here than just the musculoskeletal thing. There's more here than just the mechanics thing. And so I say all that to say, like people who have chronic pain, like in your cases, like the hips and the backs, if you're dealing with pain for a long time, it is absolutely going to affect. It's going to affect your sleep. It's going to affect your ability to recover psychologically from the day. And as those things are carried on, you know, you and I both know like sleep is crucial. And I know you've done some studies on sleep. But it's crucial for recovery, not just psychologically, but also physically. And if you're disrupting that sleep cycle overnight, you mean you drag that on for years and years. I've got back pain or hip pain. All of a sudden now I can't find a comfortable position to sleep in. So I'm not sleeping very well. And as that drags on, you start having chronic fatigue syndrome, which increases the pain response. It increases the stress and the anxiety and the depression. It just becomes this wild thing. So I'm glad that you approach it from that side of it as well, because the psychological piece of it is ultimately like they're coming to see us, yes, for pain reasons, or, you know, I'd like to be able to play with grandkids or whatever, but there's quality of life things that ultimately I think are a lot of the driver of why they come see us. It's yes, there's some physical things like I would like to be able to bend my hip to 90 degrees. Okay, awesome. Like we can measure that, but it's the like, why do you want to be able to, oh, so you can get on the floor and you can play with your three-year-old, right? So I think I'm glad you addressed those things, because I think a lot of times we get stuck, you know, I know from our trainings, like it's, you know, it used to be track range of motion and strength and those kind of things. And so there's some validity to those things, but why? Like what's the functional purpose? What's the quality of life purpose for those things? So it sounds like you're tracking all aspects.
You got to, yeah. Man. You know, you really do have to, Brian. And just the thing is, when I see a patient and there's a mechanical thing that I can fix and it's directly related to that, my heart's palpating on my chest. I'm so happy. At the same time, I absolutely love seeing patients that have chronic pain that, hey, may not have a diagnosis and trying to investigate that, yeah, and seeing how we can help them not only in their hip, but other arenas. And just like today, you mentioned about someone just being able to bend over to pick up their son or daughter. But you know, I had a patient that came on and gave me a hug today because they can kneel at church. You know, because after their treatment, yeah, you know, that's what they want.
That's right.
And it's about understanding what they want to do, right, before surgery. Mm-hmm. And if you can fix that, you know, with surgical aspects or non-surgical ways, to get them to their, right, patient-defined outcome, what
that's
they
right
want to do.
That's
not
right
just a number, you know.
That's right. And by the way, doctors and therapists, if you can find out what they really want to do,
yeah,
and you can design a treatment program around that, yeah, and they get there, your satisfaction scores go way, way up.
Because
they feel like they hear you too, right?
Yeah.
So if I'm coming to you, Dr. Wells, I'm like, man, I just want to be able to run to first base or whatever the, yeah, case can be, right? I just need, yeah, to be able to do this. And all of a sudden, because I've worked with you or worked with Brian, and now I can do these things, like my satisfaction, because you heard me, like, yeah, that was the one thing I wanted to be able to do, and now I can do it, right? It wasn't about the pain necessarily. It was like, I want to be able to do these things again.
Exactly. It's functional, yeah, pain related, yeah, but it's all about function. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I had a lady one time, this isn't necessarily a hip thing. She was having some falls. And so there was some balance issues that we were dealing with. And so I was asking the family, like, you know, what are the things that she and her husband used to love doing? Like, there's some cognitive issues now. And so, but like, when they were 5 years ago, 3 years ago, like, what things did they love to do? And so they were telling me that they used to go country line dancing. And I was, yeah, like, these guys are in their 80s. It was awesome. And so I was like, all right, here's what I want you to do. I want you to talk with your sisters. I want you to find me three songs, like their favorite songs to dance to. And so on my next treatment session with them, they FaceTimed with all the family members. And part of our balance training was actually dancing. Like, it wasn't a dry eye in the house. And so, and she was able to, because of the motor memory from being able to dance before, she was able to actually dance with her husband for like the first time, like 2 years. It was awesome. And so like, it was huge for him. It was huge for her. There's huge, you know, smiles on all of our faces because you're just relating it to something as simple as just being able to dance. They want to be able to, you know, go back to that thing.
It's wild. That's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
And, you know, and really for each patient, that means
that's
something different.
That's right.
And it just starts with listening and taking care of them.
That's right. That's right. So what other new technologies are you, because I read some things, there's some AI that it looks like some, maybe you're using too, to help determine like the leg length discrepancies. Did I read that right?
Yeah. So AI, yeah, within radiology.
Okay.
So, you know, I fully am aware that I'm only human and
right,
humans make mistakes.
Right.
And so if we can have the human aspect of understanding plus the AI aspect of maybe precision,
yeah,
that's helpful. And so I think AI is on the next level for understanding imaging, but also preventing errors within imaging. And so that's,
gotcha,
kind of predicting all the angles that I measure, the leg lengths and everything like that. I do every single case, but it's trying to speed that up, but also,
yep,
making sure that, hey, we're not making errors on the back end as well.
Are the majority of your surgeries or some of the surgeries done via like robots to help minimize some of those errors as well?
Yeah. And so that brings up an interesting thing, robots within surgery. And
yep,
so there are a lot of different artificial intelligence, however you use it, whether it's navigation, robotics, or even artificial intelligence for imaging. And so all those are routinely used in surgery. And it depends on the kind of the surgeries that we do. And so that's a whole,
sure,
talk in itself. But yes, whether it's robotics, artificial intelligence for advanced imaging, but then also navigation are used in all the surgeries we do.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. And then what are some things that you have found that I know you do a bunch of research. What are some things that you found that were striking or that were, I wasn't expecting to see that come out in the research?
My patients open my eyes to research every day. And,
yeah,
and one interesting study that we looked at was that whether BMI affected translation of the hip, right? It's just just physics. And using the kind of the simple x-rays that we get every single,
yeah,
day is that you can easily pick up joint translation according to a patient's weight. And so, of course, that's physics, but the hip being such a deep-seated socket,
oh, yeah,
you could actually pick up minor translation of the hip on certain motions on x-ray. And a patient's body weight may affect that.
Okay, so what's the BMI where you start to see that? Is there a trigger like 25?
It's a spectrum, right? Okay. It's not just one number.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's a spectrum. And so that goes to, you know, hip dysplasia and instability.
Yep.
And so it's all the mechanics. It's not just how a patient's socket is shaped. It's everything, you know, their soft tissue laxity in addition to their health and possibly their weight in addition.
Gotcha. Yeah. Do you... And I may misquote the study, but I'm fairly certain this is what it is. There's been some studies that have tried to determine, and I don't know honestly how you do this, because I know in some of these studies you have to do it with a cadaver, because there's no way to do this on live tissue, because it'd be way too painful for like a live person. But I have heard it stated or read it said that every time you take a step. So I weigh 200 pounds. Every time I take a step, it's 1.5 to 2 times my body weight when I land on my heel as I take a stride, and it's 6 to 8 times that when my body weight when I'm running. Are you seeing the same some similar studies on that too?
Yeah, so
that goes back to the BMI thing. Yeah,
yeah, there are good studies looking at that and the force. Usually it's 1 to 2 times on level ground, but it can get up to 3 times your body weight of the hip on inclines.
Okay.
Knees and ankles are different for the hip, and it has to do with your center of gravity and the lever arm of that.
Yes. Yeah. So is it 1 to 2 times your body weight at the hip joint?
At the hip joint.
So specific at the hip joint.
Exactly. Okay.
And then 3 on incline.
Yeah.
So this is where like BMI is really pretty important, because if you're doubling your body weight through your hip joint, you know, based on your body weight, then that's a lot of force on there.
It's a lot
especially
of force.
Especially if you have the hip dysplasia or even the impingement, which will amplify or accelerate that deterioration of the joint as well.
Without a doubt. But at the same time, you know, I see patients every day that were told, hey, they just have to lose weight and it's going to go away. No, the losing weight doesn't change the mechanics. And
right.
So,
I gotcha.
You know, these patients, no matter what their BMI, can be in pain because of a true pathologic thing with their hip.
Got it.
And no matter what their BMI, they still need to be treated and taken care of.
Sure. Gotcha. Okay. Very good. What's the best way to reach you? So I know you're at the Baylor Scott & White Hip Preservation Center in McKinney. And what's their phone number over there? They were going to call. Do you want to give it out?
Sure. Okay, I actually don't know if
it's
on my head.
No, I got it. It's 469.
I'm happy to give it out.
Yeah, no, you're good. It's 469-800-5750. And you're the lead guy over there, right?
Yes,
the lead doctor.
Yes.
Okay. Is there a certain patient demographic that you see more often? Are they more older folks? Are they more mid-age like me? Are they more younger, or is just... runs the whole thing?
Yeah, the nature of my practice, and I'm allowed to see at the location I'm at, 12 and older. And so I'm happy to see anyone 12 and older.
Gotcha. Do you see a lot of kids?
I see a fair amount of adolescents, yes.
Is that because of sports injuries?
Sports injuries, dysplasia, and all the other things that can come along with hips. And
gotcha.
Trauma.
Okay. Yeah. Is it majority of those seniors and geriatrics?
Just no,
because
they
had more wear and tear on them?
Actually, probably the majority of my practice that I see are probably kind of younger adults.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That are already experiencing pain, and like there's something off.
Yeah.
Are there locations of pain that help to determine like what they're dealing with, like groin versus trochanteric pain, outside hip pain, or even like in the butt?
That's a great question, Brian. And still it's being taught that, hey, if it's not the groin, it's not the hip. That's not true. And we actually published that, you know, pain location can vary, you know, and that's what makes diagnosing hip pain, true hip pain, so hard, is that it's not always in the groin. It can be lateral. It can be in the back. It can be a lot of things. And just because the pain's in the back doesn't mean it's not the hip.
That's
right. You know, and at the same time, just because it's groin doesn't mean it's just the hip. And so it can be everywhere.
Yeah, because there's this like concert play between the lumbar spine, the pelvis, and the hip. Mm-hmm. And they have to move, like they need to move independently of each other, because that's just normal function. But they move in synchronicity like with movement, like transfers or walking or stepping sideways or twisting or dancing or whatever. Like they move together. And whenever there's an impairment at one of those, like that motion has to come from someplace else. And that's usually where you start to get the more wear and tear on those, whether it's the motion isn't happening at the hip. And so now you're feeding more into the spine, or the motion isn't happening at the spine. spine and the pelvis, and now I'm putting more stress to the hip, like all those things. So I know as a therapist, like when we have someone who comes out, we're looking, and this is more my orthopedic days years ago, but we would look at the hip and we'd actually look the whole way down. Cause if the foot isn't contacting the floor correctly, like from the foot all the way up, the whole thing's kind of wonky. And so we looked from the foot all the way to the spine to see what things are happening that might be causing too much pressure or too much mobility or too much restriction at the hip joint, which is where they're complaining of the pain. And we found the same thing. Like it didn't necessarily have to be the groin. Like just because it's the groin doesn't mean it's necessarily hip arthritis. It could be something else going on with that. And same thing with the outside, you know, it could feel like it's more low back pain, but actually it could be more of the hip as well.
I love watching people walk, you know, and you can learn a lot just watching someone walk. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, we spoke of hip preservation. And so sometimes if it is the joint already starting, then sometimes it's too late to correct it. And so you got to pick it up on early. And sometimes these patients present with laterally based hip pain or buttock pain that can actually be related to their hip.
When it's the hip dysplasia or hip impingement, are you finding... I would imagine with hip dysplasia, is it more bilateral that you see that with, where the socket's not deep enough, right? So it's more of a shallow thing. That's where you get more of the slippage. Do you find that that's more of a genetic thing, like it's happening on both sides? Do you find that it's kind of a mixed bag? What are you saying?
Yeah. And so hip dysplasia can often be bilateral, but of differing severities. And so it's kind of like hips are similar to where they're kind of like sisters, where you can tell they're related, but they're not necessarily acting the same all the time. Okay. And so it's similar to that. And so it's usually differing severity. At the same time, sometimes the more severe one may not be this more symptomatic side all the time.
I've seen that too. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I know when my son had it, he was both sides, but only one of them had a palpable click to it. The other one, they can only pick up on ultrasound.
Yeah.
And so even with his case, they were both dysplasia on both sides, but they're different severities. And so, you know, if left untreated, I would imagine that the one side that had more of the slippage or translation would wear out faster. So that's probably the one, unless it was not the symptomatic one. That's probably the one that would be looked to be fixed first.
Yes. Yeah. I hope he's doing okay.
He's great. Yeah. He's 16 now. He's fine. Yeah. He's doing good. Yeah. They had him in the Geppetto costume, you know, the legs up this way for about 6 weeks and then he was fine. Like they just wanted to deepen the socket. Yeah. Yeah. So it's good. Yeah. So, all right. Well, very good, man. I really appreciate you coming out and sharing your knowledge and some things to consider with hips.
My pleasure, Brian. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you, man.